The title I gave to the evening's talk is A Fresh Look at Beginner's Mind. I'd like to begin that with a poem that was published in the New Yorker magazine in 1947 by a man named Donald Babcock. Now we are ready to look at something pretty special. It is a duck riding the ocean 100 feet beyond the surf. No, it isn't a gull. A gull always has a raucous touch about him. This is some sort of duck, and he cuddles in the swells. He isn't cold, and he is thinking things over. There's a big heaving in the Atlantic, and he is a part of it. He looks a bit like a mandarin, or the Lord Buddha meditating under the Bo tree. But he has hardly enough above the eyes to be a philosopher. He has poise, however, which is what philosophers must have. He can rest while the Atlantic heaves, because he rests in the Atlantic. Probably he doesn't know how large the ocean is, and neither do you. But he realizes it. And what does he do, I ask you? He sits down in it. He reposes in the immediate, as if it were infinity, which it is. That is religion, and the duck has it. He has made himself part of the boundless by easing himself into it just where it touches him. I like the little duck. He doesn't know much, but he has religion. What brought this poem to mind when I was reflecting upon this topic of beginner's mind is that couplet that said, "What does he do, I ask you? He sits down in it. He reposes in the immediate as if it were infinity," which it is. So when we talk about beginner's mind, I have to imagine that that term is familiar to some of you who have been involved with Buddhist practice for a while. It's become a common phrase used in Buddhist circles in the West. And perhaps for some of you who are newer, it's not so familiar. So let me just say a few words about the context from which it comes. It's associated with a beautiful Zen teacher named Suzuki Roshi, who was the founding teacher of the San Francisco Zen Center in the early 70s. The phrase is associated with a book of his talks that is somewhat of a classic in Buddhist circles, particularly Zen circles, but also more general Buddhist circles, called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And it's also associated specifically with a quote from one of his talks in that book, in which he said, quote, "In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few." And what he was pointing to is the way in which an open mind allows us to access our innate creativity because it arises out of presence rather than preconception. Can you hear that one? That is really central to every school of Buddhist practice when we get down to the heart of it. So what I want to do is tonight is really share my most recent exploration of this phrase, beginner's mind, because in a way that feels especially appropriate, I come back to this phrase every couple of years and take a fresh look at how I'm understanding it now. I first came across it literally in the early 70s when I got involved with meditation and yoga. And I noticed that when I would go back and look at that book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, for example, 4 years later, and read some of the talks that were in it and some of the phrases like the ones we're talking about here, I would understand them in a different way. Right? My assumption was that the book wasn't changing. Somehow I was understanding it and seeing it from a different perceptual stance, a different place inside myself. And that's one way to understand what unfolds for us and how we're transformed in the course of Buddhist practice. So I fairly recently came back to this phrase again. This time it was actually back on New Year's Day. Because every year, for a number of years now, I do a ceremony for our Sangha in Colorado, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. That's called the Beginning a New Ceremony, which some of you might recognize as being associated with Thich Nhat Hanh. That's something that he created, and I adapted it in certain ways for our community. As part of that ceremony, I do a preliminary talk to help people benefit, hopefully, as much as possible from the ceremony itself, which is about just what it says, beginning anew. And in our culture, New Year's Day is one of the days that many, many people have that particular mindset operating. They can, you know, buy a treadmill or whatever it is that they do when they begin anew. Yeah. What I'd suggest to you is that there's four basic principles that come into play, at least this last round of exploration for me, when we look at what we mean by beginner's mind and its relevance as contemplative practitioners, whether specifically in a Buddhist context or really in any authentic contemplative context. The first of the four principles associated with beginner's mind is what I would call a fresh start. The principle of fresh start. If Buddhism had a version of the phrase, the good news, that's used in Christian teachings, it would be this idea that we can start fresh, literally in any moment of our lives. And this applies across so many levels and dimensions of life, it's worth looking at a bit together. For example, when we sit in meditation and we're paying attention to the breath, right? What we notice is that the attention wanders off the breath and things happen. Like little noises are made. Right? And then they stop. So many different levels, though. Let's say that we could look at that within any given meditation session, particularly if we're doing a concentrative practice, right? The mind wanders, I notice it, I gently bring it back. The moment I bring it back, it's a new moment. I can be a meditator who's been sitting literally every day for 10 years, and I can go on a vacation and some significant personal dilemma can come up. I could stop sitting for a few days and just not pick it up again when I come home. Right? A year and a half later, I still haven't been doing any practice. And then someone gives me a Dharma book as a gift. I read the book, I get re-inspired. The next morning I sit down on a practice again. I'm right back on the cushion. It's a new moment. When I was doing a lot of private practice work as a clinical psychotherapist, I used to work with people who had closed head injuries, oftentimes from car accidents. And I remember what it was like for someone, one person in particular who I worked with for about 3 years at one point, who was in a very bad car accident coming down Boulder Canyon in Colorado, flipped her car. Physically, she wasn't hurt that badly, but she injured her brain. This was a brilliant woman who was just about finished with her PhD. Yeah. After the accident, she couldn't read. And when your defining characteristic that you've been stroked for and acknowledged for and praised for your entire life has been your intellect, and the next day you wake up and you can't read, That's a new moment. That's a fresh start. It's painful and it's difficult. And yet, this woman went into cognitive therapy and combined it with psychotherapy and spent several years working on her situation, eventually did finish her doctorate and get licensed as a psychologist. Yeah. Writer Barbara Kingsolver captured some of what I'm talking about here with fresh start in these words. Every one of us is called upon, probably many times, to start a new life. A frightening diagnosis, a marriage, a move, loss of a job, or a limb, or a loved one, a graduation, bringing a new baby home. It's impossible to think at first how this will all be possible. Eventually, what moves it forward is the subterranean ebb and flow of being alive among the living. In my own worst seasons, I've come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing, a flame of red geranium outside my bedroom window. And then another, my daughter in a yellow dress. And another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon. Until I learn to be in love with my life again. Like a stroke victim retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills, I have taught myself joy over and over again. Think about your own life for a moment. In the times when you have felt challenged to start over and find joy again, wondering if you'll be able to do it this time. Yeah. I have a good friend in Colorado who last year was in a really joyful part of his life. Basically, he was retired, pretty independent financially, went on a trip to Australia where his son teaches at a university in Melbourne, and was having a glorious time on this trip. And then he started feeling unwell. And at first he thought it was just a virus or a traveler's bug and so forth. But it was something different. Long story short, turned out to be a fourth stage lung cancer diagnosis. Right? Interesting to see the process that he went through. We talked a lot because he knew I used to do a lot of hospice work and had directed hospice programs in the past and still do some work with people in end-of-life situations. And we had a number of conversations, and he was fortunate to have a really beautiful support system. His other son lives right in the area of Boulder with his daughter-in-law and their two kids, and he has a wonderful circle of friends who came and supported him as he went through treatment. And at the same time, the diagnosis was very serious and the prognosis was grim, and he knew it. So we talked a lot about it. I myself was feeling the grief and just wondering what it would be like to not see this person alive on the planet and preparing myself for him to die. Then he sent out this email to all of his close friends. There was a circle of us that were kind of supporting and tracking his medical situation. To my dear friends, and this is with his permission, by the way. His name's Lou. And I asked him if it would be okay to share this. To my dear friends and family members far and wide, as you all know, I was on death's, if not door, then at least in the driveway. Just 3 months ago, with lung cancer that had spread widely in my body, according to the PET and CT scans at the time. Well, today I got the results of another PET and CT scan, that was taken this week. And I want to let you know, I am cancer free. Nothing, nada, not a speck anywhere. Now, the PET CT scans don't measure cancer at the molecular level, where it can reside and reassert at a later time, but the targeted drug therapy I've been doing for the last 3 months, it's a drug called Tarceva, has miraculously killed off all the active growing cancer cells. And when my body begins to resist this drug somewhere down the road, I have at least two more lines of defense against this disease. And who knows what else is in the pipeline. So to all of you who worried and were shocked and aggrieved at what had befallen me, and who also prayed, sent good wishes, visited, helped me stand and walk, and were with me in spirit, I thank you for all of that and more, because somewhere during 3 months, those 3 months, my spirit revived and my body accepted the gift of healing that was evoked not only by the medicine and wonderful care I received during the darkest days, but also by all of your love and caring. I also came to a place of gratitude for my own life and for the beauty of all that I feel connected to in the best and the worst of times. All of that and more led me today to not be truly surprised by this wonderful news. Inside, I knew it already. In love and gratitude, Lou. Fresh start. And his health has maintained. For how long? Hard to say. But the wakefulness that he's living with now is quite extraordinary for obvious reasons. As I think a lot of you know, there's a practice in Buddhism called Maranasati, which is usually translated as death awareness practice. And it's consistent with something we see in many contemplative traditions, that keeping death in our awareness has a way of inspiring us to live fully and appreciate the time we have when we're here. The practices are not intended to be grim necessarily, although sometimes they're interpreted that way. They're intended to wake us up to the uncertainties that we're all living with, the fragility of this human body, and the beginner's mind that really never knows what's going to happen from one moment to the next and from one day to the next. One of my first insight meditation teachers is familiar to many of you, perhaps Joseph Goldstein, who's wrote a book in 1976 about insight meditation. That's when I switched over from studying in the Tibetan tradition and made insight meditation what I think of as my home path, if you will. Joseph is fond of saying at some point when he teaches and gives talks, with a sort of enigmatic grin on his face, he'll look out at us and say, "Just remember, anything can happen at any time." And whenever he does that, I get this combination of chills and excitement, because it feels to me like he's saying, wake up, pay attention. Sometimes we go through our lives with a certain mindset, a preconceived belief about something, and some experience comes along and flips it completely on its ear, and we realize that we've understood in a distorted way something that we now understand with clarity. Here's an example of this one from a story someone shared with me. A new monk arrives at the monastery. He is assigned to help the other monks in copying the old texts by hand. He notices, however, that they are copying from copies, not from the original manuscripts. So the new monk goes to the head monk to ask him about this, pointing out that if there were an error in the first copy, that error would be continued in all the subsequent copies. The head monk then said, "We've been copying from copies for centuries. But you make a good point, my son. So he goes down into the cellar with one of the copies to check it against the original. Hours go by, and nobody sees him. So one of the monks goes downstairs to look for him. Hearing sobbing coming from the back of the cellar, he finds the old monk leaning over one of the original books, crying. He asks the old monk, "What's wrong?" And in a choked voice came the reply. "The word is celebrate." What a bad break. So the first of these principles, fresh start, right? The second one I want to talk about has to do with the importance and power of intention. Those of you familiar with the law of karma, as it's taught in the Buddhist tradition, are aware, perhaps, that the way the Buddha taught about karma, which was actually different from the Hindu tradition from which Buddha's teachings arose, is that he emphasized intentionality as the essence of karma. Right? He recognized something that I think, at least in my experience, is quite true. Right? I have a great deal more influence and control over the intention I bring to an action than I do the outcome. So much of what goes on out there in our lives, particularly if you look at the planet as we sit here, feels quite out of our control, and oftentimes is. And so the Buddha said something that I think about a lot. He said, it's the intention behind an action that determines its karmic fruit in the way it shapes our awakening process, the way it shapes our personality, the way it shapes our character. The other reason that's important is because if you look at how mindfulness enables us to pay more attention and gain more insight into the motives we're operating with, if we see an intention arise in consciousness in relation to an action or speech that's not skillful, we still have room to make a choice not to act or speak. So mindfulness of intention is something that arises in relation to and precedes any voluntary action whatsoever. If I can pay attention to that, I can make wiser choices. Does that make sense? It's easy to talk about. Right? It's harder to do. At the same time, one way we could look at the whole Buddhist path of awakening as that it involves cultivating mindfulness and compassion in our moment-to-moment and day-to-day experiencing, noticing what kinds of choices we make, and usually called wholesome or skillful in Buddhist vocabulary, right, that lead to happiness and well-being for myself and others, and intentionally furthering those kinds of choices. If I flip that over, I begin to notice what kinds of intentions arise prior to unskillful actions, and what happens when I act on those intentions in unskillful or unwholesome ways, and I see that they lead to suffering for myself and or others. Right? The more that I can notice that, and the more I can understand which intentions go in which direction, the more I can make choices that shape my life in a new way, in the direction of wholesomeness and well-being. More joy, more well-being, more happiness, less suffering. So intentions matter tremendously in this sense. Right? They don't need to be finger-wagged, and we don't have to moralize about them, and we don't have to make grand assumptions about our character, as some of us tend to do, because we often have very harsh super-egos operating. Rather, in a light and mindful way, we can just notice which choices lead to suffering for myself and others, which lead to happiness. And we can cultivate the intention to focus on those that lead to well-being. Right? That's why in many traditions, you know, when we sit down to practice, when I lived and trained in Nepal for several years, every time we sat down to practice, we started by paying attention to our intention. For the benefit of all beings, may I practice the holy Dharma here and now. For the benefit of all beings. So that was the intention that we were reminded of every time we sat. So that plays a key role here in relation to this beginner's mind, because if our intentions get off track or we find ourselves acting unskillfully, we can always start over. And the place to start over is, what's my intention? Like I sometimes do organizational development work, and if I'm going to facilitate a meeting where there's a lot of contentiousness and a lot of conflict, I'll often sit quietly before I go into that situation and try to get as clear as I can about what my intention is for myself and for the outcome of that meeting. Doesn't mean I'll be able to achieve it necessarily, but it means that I'm clear about what my intention is. The same is true on interpersonal relationships. You know, if my wife and I or my daughter and I have a falling out or a disagreement about something and we're going to have a come to Buddha talk about it. Before I go and sit down with one of them, I'll get quiet and I'll just say, what's my desired outcome here? What's my intention for this conversation? Do I want to be right or do I want to connect? Because those happen to be exclusive, oftentimes. Right? So intention is the second of these factors I would suggest to you, you could pay attention to in a new way, if you want to take the invitation I'm offering tonight. Yeah? The third one I want to talk about, perhaps is somewhat obvious in terms of its association to beginner's mind, right? To creating a fresh start. It has to do with forgiveness. There's a beautiful teacher in Northern California named Ajahn Pasano at a place called Abhayagiri Monastery, one of the first Theravadan monasteries in the States. Originally, there were co-abbots there. There was a beautiful teacher named Ajahn Amaro, who was my mentor teacher when I was training at Spirit Rock years ago. Ajahn Pasano sort of rewrote the traditional version of the forgiveness practice that's often used for people both in the monastic setting and also in lay life. And I just want to share it with you so you can get a sense of what we're talking about. Let's see where we ended up. Well, let me give it to you from memory. So you start and you get kind of quiet. And you take a few breaths in and out of your heart. You recognize that forgiveness is never to be forced. Right? When I used to work with people who had been traumatized or abused, for example, they would often describe how their friends would say things to them that were well-intended but not necessarily helpful. You just have to forgive. Just forgive that person. And while that might be eventually true, if the healing is going to occur, at an early stage of a situation where someone's working with something that's been incredibly inappropriate and painful, they don't need to be told that they should forgive the person at that point in the process. It's way too early. And it would be forced. Sometimes the most a person could muster, and sometimes they couldn't even muster that, was the intention to someday forgive, because they could intellectually recognize it might be helpful. And that was about the most that they could do. But in this case, you sit down, pay attention to your heart, you breathe into it, and you work with phrases like, I allow myself to be imperfect. I allow myself to make mistakes. I allow myself to be a learner, still learning life's lessons. I forgive myself. And this last line, note this last line. If I cannot forgive myself now, may I forgive myself at some point in the future. You're planting a seed of intention. Yeah. Then you turn it around. Let's say someone has injured me, physically, emotionally, or otherwise, spiritually perhaps. Right? Then I take those same phrases and recognize that they're human just like me. And I turn it around and I say, just as I allow myself to be imperfect, I allow you to be imperfect. Just as I allow myself to make mistakes, I allow you to make mistakes. Just as I allow myself to be a learner, I allow you to be a learner, still learning life's lessons. I forgive you. If I cannot forgive you now, may I forgive you at some point in the future. And then you finish it with recognizing that if I did something harmful to another person that hurt them, I want to at least lay the internal groundwork for approaching them and asking for their forgiveness. Whether I actually will or not on the physical plane is secondary at this point, right? And I think of the person that I perhaps unintentionally did emotional harm to. And I go back with those phrases, you know. I visualize the person. I say in my heart and mind to the person, please allow me to be imperfect. Please allow me to make mistakes. Please allow me to be a learner, still learning life's lessons. Please forgive me. If you cannot forgive me now, may you forgive me at some point in the future. You can just feel the energy of that kind of practice. Because one of the things that's epidemic, from my perspective in this culture right now, is a kind of perfectionism that causes an incredible amount of emotional and psychological distress. Having worked with people in a variety of people-helping roles for a lot of years now, it's a heartbreak to see how brutal a lot of our inner conversations are and some of the ways we expect ourselves to be so perfect, as if that's somehow going to finally get us the love that that little child in us that's so wounded thinks it can get by some kind of imaginary perfection. I gave a talk several years ago that really resonated with some of the people in our Sangha. It was called On Becoming an Imperfectionist. And it just kind of struck that note, if you will. And there was one part of me that just wanted to look at, sort of stand on top of the Empire State Building and go, will you relax? Just relax. Settle back into your own being. See your own basic goodness. Give yourself permission to learn and make mistakes and enjoy your life a little bit. Please. Right? Jack Kornfield put it in an interesting way. He kind of summarized some of these first principles: fresh start, intentionality, and forgiveness. He put it this way. Whatever your difficulties, a devastated heart, financial loss, feeling assaulted by the conflicts around you, or a seemingly hopeless illness, you can always remember that you are free in every moment to set the compass of your heart to your highest intentions. In fact, the two things you are always free to do, despite your circumstances, are to be present and to be willing to love. No one and no circumstance can take away the option to make those choices. And when we learn to that when we experience, not conceptually, but on a felt level, the truth of that statement that Jack made, there's a kind of lightness of being that starts to become a reality in our day-to-day lives rather than just a nice idea that we read in the book. And when it's really highly developed, it's amazing how it's possible as a human being to transform the most difficult circumstance into something that's a learning opportunity or a joyful event or something that's just recognized without too much struggle. I'll give you an example. Let's see if I can find this one. This is a beautiful Tibetan Buddhist teacher, born in France originally, named Matthieu Ricard. Some of you might know him. He's associated with the Mind and Life Institute that does a lot of contemplative neuroscience, studying the relationship of the brain to meditation training. Just watch how he handles a really difficult situation. I remember a train trip through India, undertaken in rather difficult and turbulent conditions. I had reserved my seat, a good idea for a 36-hour journey. But my car, this is so India, my car was never attached to the train. I've been there. And I found myself in a substitute wagon, jam-packed, having no compartments, and no glass in the windows. Huddling on a wooden berth with a half dozen frozen travelers, and parenthetically, it was January, I observed the hundreds of other passengers crammed into their seats and on the corridor floors. On top of it all, I had a high fever and lumbago. We were traveling through Bihar, a country of bandits, and the passengers had chained up their luggage wherever they could. I was used to traveling in India, and I stowed the briefcase containing my laptop and an entire month's work in an apparently secure corner of the upper berth. Nevertheless, it was spirited away by an innovative thief from the neighboring berth, presumably with some kind of hook. As night fell, I realized what had happened. Then, the lights went out for several hours. So there I was, wrapped in my sleeping bag, listening to the cursing of passengers frantically trying to keep tabs on their luggage in the dark. Suddenly, I realized that, far from being upset, I felt incredibly light and experienced a feeling of total felicity and freedom. You may imagine that the fever was making me delirious, but I was absolutely clear-headed. And the contrast between the situation and my feelings was so comical that I began to laugh out loud in the dark. This was definitely not a case of happiness via relief. Rather, it was an experience... Oh, did I just turn off? Lost the battery.
Oh. Yeah? Well, we're having weird battery issues.
Well, that's cool. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Well, then I don't have things keep this dangling in front of my nose, do I? This was definitely not a case of happiness via relief. Rather, it was an experience of innate serenity brought into sharper focus by particularly unpleasant external circumstances. It was a moment of letting go. That state of deep satisfaction found only within oneself and which is therefore independent of external circumstances. We cannot deny the existence of pleasant and unpleasant sensations, but they are trivial with respect to genuine well-being. Such experiences have helped me to see that it is certainly possible to live in a state of abiding happiness. So we have fresh start, we have intention, paying attention to intention, we have the importance of forgiveness, and then we have a last point here that I just touched on, which is taking a fresh look periodically at what vision of awakening you're holding in your practice and your life. How do you understand what words like enlightenment
or liberation, or awakening, or freedom. What do they actually mean? We use them a lot in Buddhist circles because they're associated with the ultimate goal of the practice. At the same time, having grown up in a Western culture, as many of us or all of us here have, a culture which is obsessed with achievement orientation and often sets us up to be striving for literally unreachable goals that are like receding horizons, how do we know what's guiding our practice? What vision of awakening or enlightenment do we hold? What I've noticed in the time I've been practicing over the years is that part of how I understand the spiritual journey is that it involves a constantly changing process of how I understand what the goal of practice is. For example, when I was a 21-year-old undergraduate at Tulane University, 1971, I read a book on yoga and a book on Buddhism, and I started to try to practice out of these books. And I had a very simple, naive notion of what awakening was. Right? And I was unenlightened. If I did these practices, the more the better, in some kind of straight line trajectory, I would go from unenlightened to enlightened. Right? And there was suffering when you're unenlightened, and there was none when you were enlightened. It was pretty straightforward. Yeah. I'm envious of people who can see it that way. Certainly, is that, you know, 5 years later, 10 years later, 30 years later, 40 years later, it kept changing. Right? There kept being a new and deep and fresh view of what awakening is. And I don't know how well I can articulate how I understand it at this point, but it's certainly alive as a vision and goal for my life. It's the organizing principle around which I live my life. And so my invitation to you would be to recognize that it can be a valuable part of your practice to periodically either read something excellent. Guy Armstrong has a book out now called Emptiness that speaks to some of these deep principles of practice. Rodney Smith, from the Seattle Insight Organization, has written beautifully a book about how to understand what awakening is. Joseph Goldstein's book on mindfulness, and likely to become a classic, talks about his take, after many years of being a teacher and practitioner, on what awakening is. Tibetans love to talk about awakening. Zen teachers don't talk about awakening. They just kind of slap you and make it happen. But find out what works for you, right? And if you're going to go to a Zen session, just wear a helmet. Don't wear a helmet. So let me just kind of... I want to allow some time for discussion here. So when people approach the spiritual life, the deepening of who and what we are, the transformation that's possible for us as human beings, and really that includes an innate capacity for self-transcendence in relation to the small self. Right? When one does that over an extended period of time, there's a way of living that organically comes to the surface. And you can see it in this quote that I'll close with, because this is not someone classically known as a spiritual guide or teacher, but clearly someone who understood what I've been talking about tonight and who daily took a fresh look at beginner's mind. And this was written by Pablo Casals when he was 93 years old. Each day I am reborn. Each day I must begin again. For the past 80 years, I have started each day in the same manner. It is not a mechanical routine, but something essential to my daily life. I go to the piano, and I play two preludes and fugues by Bach. I cannot think of doing otherwise. It is a sort of benediction on the house. But that is not its only meaning for me. It is a rediscovery of the world of which I have the joy of being a part. It fills me with the awareness of the wonder of life, with a feeling of the incredible marvel of being a human being. The music is never the same for me. Never. Each day, it is something new, fantastic, and unbelievable.